I'm Zoe Kleinman and this is Business Daily. Today we're exploring the data and economics around older or geriatric mothers, to use the controversial medical term. Why are many women delaying motherhood?
Women are spending longer in education and trying to get on the housing ladder, and that's no mean feat. You can begin to see what some of the pressures are and why people are beginning to delay their childbearing years.
How's technology helping, and what does the law say about all things fertility and the workplace?
It's slightly problematic if women rely on technology and say, well, I'll leave my childbearing much later because then I can still have a baby.
That's Business Daily on the BBC. The heartbeat of my unborn baby at a recent checkup. As I'm talking to you now, I'm not far away from my due date. And as a woman pregnant in her early 40s, I've found the whole experience of being what's termed geriatric to be a fascinating one. I've been treated quite differently to my two previous pregnancies in my 30s. But I'm hardly alone in giving birth at the grand old age of 43. Well over 100,000 women in the US alone have children in their 40s every year. So why does it cause so much commentary? After all, it's not hard to see why delaying motherhood makes sense to many. The competitive world of work isn't always the most accommodating. Having children can be expensive, and housing costs in many parts of the world are prohibitively high, meaning space to raise a family might not be something available until late into your 30s and beyond. While there's a tendency to regard motherhood in your 40s as a modern trend, it actually was rather commonplace here in the UK and elsewhere generations ago. More women were having babies in their 40s in the late 1930s and 40s than do now, although the data shows they were continuing to grow their families rather than starting from scratch at that age. Women, quite simply, spent a lot of their lives pregnant. So let's start with these terms and where the idea, often repeated in the media, that past 40 is too late, comes from.
My name is Amy Kiefer, and I live in California with my three children, and I've been writing about fertility and pregnancy and breastfeeding for about 7 years now, but my training is as a researcher.
What do you think about this term, you know, geriatric mum?
I think it obviously wasn't created by a woman. I think that's most women's reaction was no woman came up with this term. It's applied to women who are 35 and older, who are in the prime of their lives and hardly think of themselves as geriatric. I think now people are shifting to use the term advanced maternal age more often, which is a little bit more neutral. It still seems to suggest that there's something abnormal about having a pregnancy at 35 or older, which is not really true if you look at the historical record.
So tell me about that.
So this is really fascinating. So some demographers went back and looked at the age of last birth in women in the 18th and 19th centuries. And they did that because they wanted to look at when women were having their last child before modern fertility treatments were available, before the birth control was widely available. And what they found is that the median age of last birth was around 40, 41 in six different populations.
So naturally, these women were naturally having their last children in their early 40s.
That's correct. So about half of the women had their last birth before 40 or 41, and then about half of them had it after. And so it was very normal for women to be having their last birth in their early 40s. What was even more fascinating to me was that one of the first things that happened, they call this the demographic transition, is that starting in the late 1700s in France and then moving sort of throughout Europe and throughout the Western world, women started ending fertility period earlier. And so when we look at slightly later populations, it's not representative of what women's natural fertility potential is.
Science writer Amy Kiefer. How is workplace law keeping up with later motherhood? As fertility inevitably declines, many women will want or need to access fertility treatment, or possibly even other options like surrogacy.
Yes, I'm Louisa Gevart, founder of Louisa Gevart Associates, specialist fertility and family law firm. Well, I've been a family lawyer for over 20 years. Work covers a wide range of issues from preconception through to pregnancy, birth, parenting and family life, and it can encompass anything from fertility preservation to donor conception, surrogacy, fertility treatment law, and even things like posthumous conception. So it's very busy.
I wanted Louisa to tell us how she sees things having changed in the last decade or so.
We've seen huge changes across the sector. We now have better assisted reproductive technology and success rates, and there's more demand for fertility treatment. IVF success rates in broad terms are 3 times better than they were in 1991. We've seen a tenfold increase in egg freezing over the last 10 years. We've seen increases in egg and sperm donation. But what this is doing, interestingly, is it's feeding into trends in later life parenthood. Part of this wider picture is to do with education and training. Women are spending longer in education. They're thinking about the need for secure accommodation and trying to get on the housing ladder. And that's no mean feat. You can begin to see what some of the pressures are and why people are beginning to delay and pause even more their childbearing years.
So what needs to be updated from a legislative perspective? I asked Louisa.
At the moment, legislation is all focused around being pregnant and then going on to have a baby. The problem is that if you've got to access fertility treatment because you're a bit older or you're battling infertility, there's a huge lead-in time to that, and that's not catered for. Many employers still don't have a workplace policy to support workers trying to undergo assisted reproductive technology or surrogacy. Fundamentally, there has been a laissez-faire attitude towards fertility management. Although the World Health Organization categorizes infertility as a disease of the reproductive system, it's still not embedded in law. There isn't this joined up approach.
Is the global fertility market a bit of a wild west?
There has been a lack of legal harmonisation across many different disciplines within the fertility sector, whether it's allowing or banning surrogacy, whether it's identifiable or non-identifiable donors, whether it's altruistic or commercial donors, and varying standards internationally as well about the regulation, oversight and delivery of fertility treatment. Different nation states have different attitudes for historical, cultural, economic, religious reasons. There is, quite frankly, insufficient international governance.
Louisa Gavard. Well, over in India, there's long been a lot of controversy surrounding surrogacy and what some term surrogacy farms, where women live in dormitories and are paid to birth a child on behalf of a couple or single parent. It raises a lot of debate, as the BBC's Davina Gupta explored in 2019. She started by speaking to Sandeep Sapaka, a choreographer and single parent.
Why didn't you consider commercial surrogacy at that time?
Well, very simple. I didn't have that kind of money at all.
Okay.
$30,000 is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I don't have that kind of money. It's not the blood that is thicker. It is just the bonding that you have with the child makes you grow with the child and makes the relationship better. So I think adoption was the only option for me, and I'm very happy I did it.
It's a wonderful thought. We also have Professor Mohan Rao. He's a leading academician in India and also is holding multiple panels for public health policies in India.
I think India should ban commercial surrogacy. I think commercial surrogacy is a form of labor which I do not think should be recognized as legitimate labor. I think it belongs to the other kinds of labor which we do not permit. We do not permit slavery, we do not permit bonded labor, we do not permit child labor, and so on. And so to recognize it as any other kind of labor which mm-hmm. should be compensated is a deeply problematic position which comes from looking at things through the lens of reproductive choice. Mm-hmm. That does not give us reproductive justice.
Dr. Preeti Gupta, leading IVF specialist in this field for 19 years, who has met a lot of parents who won't believe what Mohan has just said.
Absolutely not.
And can you compare it to slavery and
not
child bondage?
Not at all. Can you legalize begging? Do you want her to beg? Do you want her to go for prostitution? She's choosing a way. It's her body. And she is choosing a way. There are people, if you come to meet these surrogates, there are people who do not have any other option. There are people coming to me who, they're young people having 2 children, left their husband, has left them, they're alone. Who will take care of them? Will the government come?
And as a former politician called Joyce Lay told BBC Africa Daily's Alan Kazuja in Kenya, it's not simple either. A decade ago, her son was born with a surrogate.
The Act says the woman who gives birth to a child is the mother of the baby. That's what our Act says right now under Children's Act. We had to sign these legal papers to show that when the surrogate mother gives birth, the baby is ours, belongs to us. But then at the hospital, they could not give us a notification of birth under my name and my husband's name. Reason, because their hands are tied because of that Act that says the woman who gives birth is the mother of the baby. And then we were told, now you use this notification to now go back to the courts and seek for adoption. The process took us 4 years to officially and legally be recognized as the parents to our son.
The global picture is pretty confused. It can also be extremely expensive. I chatted to Rebecca Romo Tegg. She had a child in her teens, then again in her 30s and 40s.
I had people ask me outright if I got pregnant naturally, which just blew my mind. I kind of refused to answer those questions because, just in solidarity with friends of mine who have gone through IVF, I think it's nobody's business how a baby came about.
Are people spending an awful lot of money on treatment?
It is expensive, but that expense is passed on to the healthcare companies, the health insurance companies, which you pay a premium. And that healthcare coverage varies state to state, and it also varies depending on which employer you have. We are currently paying $85 a month to store our embryos, which we got during a retrieval. Retrievals at our healthcare facility cost around $12,000 out of pocket. A transfer costs $4,000 out of pocket. An embryo transfer costs around $4,000 out of pocket. Then if you are older, they're going to suggest that you have the PGT testing, which samples an embryo to ensure there's no genetic abnormalities, which would result in a miscarriage following the transfer. And the PGT testing, depending on how many embryos you have, costs between $4,000 and $11,000.
Wow. And you're paying that?
The PGT testing was not covered by our health insurance. So yes, it is expensive. But then when you look at the flip side, adoption is also very expensive here. So
is it?
Yeah, yeah. Unless you're going through the foster care system, it's around $50,000. I do think the other thing that's gaining momentum is younger women going through the retrieval process for the goal of freezing their eggs for the future. A very close friend of mine, when I told her I was starting this, told me that her brother and his wife, she froze her eggs in her 20s. This was in LA, and her clinic also serviced several celebrities that we all think have had babies naturally on their own.
It's something that's not talked about.
No. I feel like we keep so many things a secret.
So where does this leave us? I spoke to one woman who has a long career in fertility and childbirth.
So my name is Dame Cathy Warwick, and I'm currently chair of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. Technology has enabled women to make different choices, which I think is a good thing. On the other hand, I think it's slightly problematic if women rely on technology and say, well, I'll leave my childbearing much later because then I can still have a baby. There's no doubt at all that women's fertility and men's fertility does change over the years. So I do think women need to be glad that the technology exists, but also realise that their chances of getting pregnant are less.
And yet, it's in the UK and indeed around the world, it's a multi-million dollar industry, isn't it? Are these companies selling these products responsibly, do you think?
I mean, it is very expensive for women. And certainly in the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, the organisation I'm chair of, we're looking at whether we can provide infertility really at cost to women. We won't be set up as a business model. We're a charity, and we simply want to ensure that all women can make their own reproductive choices. The other thing that does add to the cost of fertility treatment is that there are always a lot of add-ons. And there are some questions around as to whether all of these add-ons are necessary. And, you know, that might be additional scans, it might be additional drugs. In a sense, we don't want to take advantage of women who are very, very desperate to have a baby and who therefore will understandably try things that they're recommended.
A lot of women travel internationally, don't they, seeking fertility treatment. I mean, it feels like it's a bit of a wild west, doesn't it, in a sense?
Yes, and I mean, I think that raises this whole question as to why is infertility not treated like any other medical condition? So I think that is a big debate around the infertility issue as to whether it's something women should just put up with, on, if you put it crudely, or whether it is something that is a condition that women should be entitled to treatment for.
What I hadn't realised, and I've learned making this programme, is that IVF, even when it's very effective, doesn't work a lot of the time, does it? The success rate is about a third, I understand.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, that is sort of another fundamental problem, that it isn't a panacea for all infertility. And there will be many women who still find that they come out of an expensive cycle of treatment or three expensive cycles without a baby, which is very sad, really. I suppose that moves you into all these questions about, is there some way that we could, if you like, change the discussion, change the context? There are some aspects of the way we live that make women feel they've failed if they can't have a baby. And perhaps that's where we can change the discourse a bit more, because many women have very successful lives without children.
It feels like the world has some catching up to do when it comes to women needing affordable support to have a baby as and when they feel the time is right. Do join us for more Business Daily soon.
Producer Sarah Trenor here. In the couple of weeks since we recorded this programme, Zoe has given birth to a healthy baby boy.